Hi.
It's Anna.
It's Shireen.
This is Ethnically Ambiguous.
Episode 40.
In this episode, I am going to break down what the Iran nuclear deal is, what it gave us, what it gave Iran, and yeah.
Yeah. And then I'm going to talk about Nazik al-Abid, who was a badass feminist in the early 1900s, and what she did for Syria, and why she's known as the Syrian Joan of Arc.
Who are we? Where did we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pants? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Yo!
Hi!
We're back! And this is episode 40. We're in our 40s.
This is 40.
40 is the new 20. That's what 40-year-old women say to themselves.
It's the age my mom turns every year. 40.
That's 35 for my mom. My mom's really, really pushing.
She's
it.
She's young.
Yeah, I know.
Eight kids? Just kidding. Your mom doesn't have eight kids.
She has three.
My mom does. Just kidding. Mom doesn't have eight kids either. Why would she? You know? Sorry, I'm taking my shoes off if you hear a little bit of rustling. Yeah, I only record podcasts with my feet free and clear. Is that the creepiest thing you've ever heard? So, what did you do this week?
What did I do this week?
This is the what we did this week corner.
What did I do this week? Well, this was my first... I finished a freelance job last week, so I caught up on my sleep this week because I'm off. And I hung out with some dogs. My friend walks dogs as a side gig, and I hung out with some of these dogs that made my day. I have made some regrettable decisions in the past couple of months as far as my... love life goes, and I had to pay for those this week.
Let's talk about it in detail.
No, thanks. Oh yeah! Today, me and Anna were both on the Daily Zeitgeist, and,
Right, so when you hear this, it will have dropped this past week on Thursday.
Thursday?
Yeah, today's Thursday.
It's gonna drop today?
Yeah, it's the Daily Zeitgeist.
What time does it drop?
Dropped in like an hour.
Oh, I always thought you guys were, in my mind, I thought you guys recorded the day before that it dropped for some reason. You know, I thought it would go out tomorrow. But I guess it's, sorry, my mind's blown. Podcasting is a crazy world.
Wow, you wonder why I'm so tired all the time?
No, it makes a lot more sense now. But yeah, we recorded it today and it was a fun time. I wasn't on for the whole episode. I was on for the end part and we talked a little about the travel ban and just all the good stuff that's going on in politics right now. So you guys should listen to it. If you guys listen to the Daily Zeitgeist, it's a really good time with Jack and Miles.
Yes. And I didn't say too much because I was literally like about to shit myself. I had a
muffin.
I had a muffin this morning and then I had a coffee, like a big coffee. I don't know why. I just like poured so much and I was like, well, whatever. I guess I'll drink it. Never do that. Just pour it out. Like, right. I don't know why I thought that was a good idea. Next thing you know, in the middle of this goddamn recording, my stomach starts to be like, mayday, mayday, mayday. And then Jack's like, all right, you want to bring Shireen in? And I'm like, yeah, totally, dude. And then I just, there was a moment in time where literally, like, I could see Shireen talking into the mic. And the only thing going on in my mind was like, don't shit your pants in this recording right now. And it was wild. And like, people like look at me and I just, there was like nothing going on right in my mind. You guys thought I was like trying to like come up with things to say. No, only thing in my mind was do not shit your pants in this recording with like five people. Like Andrew T from Yo, Is This Racist was there. It was a situation.
Well, sharding happens to the best of us. I'm glad I didn't go that far.
It wouldn't have been a shart. It would have been a full on I shit my pants. Like there would have been like, oh, wetness. No, it would have been like the whole situation would have came out into my pants.
Yeah, I mean, I think it happens to the best of us. When I did stand up for like the hottest minute ever, a very short time, my first set was about sharding, about how I sharded in a crossroads.
Crossroads.
I said it was a Buffalo Exchange in my set because I was like too embarrassed that I was even in a crossroads. But I guess Buffalo
Exchange
is
just as bad.
They're
literally the same thing, aren't they?
Yeah, I don't know why. I just have this idea that crossroads is like the bougie place to go.
Crossroads is like the clothes are a little bit more,
like
a little more basic, and then Buffalo Exchange leans a little bit more towards like vintagey vibe.
Yeah. But regardless, sharding happens to the best of us, and I'm glad it didn't.
I do
want to
make it clear I didn't actually shit my pants.
But it was close.
It was close. My stomach was like giving me a false alarm because like when I did end up going to the bathroom, like it was fine. Like I didn't actually have to even shit. It was just like a very aggressive moment in my life where I was also at the same time recording a podcast. I literally didn't know. Like I told Zach, I was like, not Zach, excuse me, Jack. I don't know. Sorry. I'm very confused in life. I told Jack, I was like, if I just stand up and leave the recording at any point, it's because I'm about to shit myself. And he was like, oh, cool. And I was like, just FYI.
Slide into my BMs. I made up that today. I'm proud of it, to be honest.
God damn it.
But yeah, listen to the Daily Zeitgeist. It's a fun time.
Yeah, so just, but keep in mind everything I'm saying, like, I'm in a full panic. Like, I'm in full panic mode. That's a little background on what's going on. I just got an alert on my phone from Domino's, just FYI, if you want to know how my life is going. No wonder I'm shitting my pants. Okay. So that was our week.
Yeah. Yeah. Avoided a shitstorm.
Mm-hmm. Literally.
Yeah. And then watched another shitstorm happening in politics.
What would you have done if I'd actually, like, it just happened and I was like, I just tried to play it off like I had to, like, I'm just like, you guys, I'm trying to like do an impression of myself trying to pretend like I hadn't just shit my pants in a studio when everyone clearly knows I just shit my pants. How would you have reacted?
I think I probably would have been like, let's take a quick break.
You would break the show you don't even host. You're like, and I think it's time.
Yeah, that would technical have been difficulties in Anna's pants.
Fucking for real. I would have never lived it down in the office.
Oh, no. No.
There would be like,
there's no coming back from that.
It would be like a holiday in the office of the day Anna shit her pants in a recording.
Oh. Well.
April 26th. The day.
No, it didn't happen,
now
you guys.
Now it's the day I almost shit my pants
in
a recording.
It didn't happen.
The one day they asked me to cop on and do a segment about the. God damn it.
But yeah,
I didn't do much else this week. I did see Paddington 2.
Oh, did you see the first one too?
No. Yeah, I did.
Oh, I did. I haven't seen either of them. Are they decent?
Great. It's a great metaphor for refugee life. It's wonderful.
Oh shit.
It's very deep. It's deeper than you think.
Yeah, word. I'll try to check it out.
Word. Yeah, no, it's tight. If there's one description I could say about Paddington 2, it's tight.
It's tight.
No, it's just really good, and I recommend everyone watches it. It's just fun. It's a good time. It's a bear.
Yeah, I remember I liked Paddington the books. He was a cutie. His little raincoat. I'm all into that. I'm about that style icon.
It's a hat, a raincoat, no pants.
That's me every day.
Also, the like Nashville, a Waffle House shooter had no pants on.
What? Really?
Yeah, that was his whole thing. He came on like pantsless.
Yeah,
which to me
guy.
It's like, if we've gotten to a point where our shooters are just not even wearing pants anymore,
like they really have no shame,
we've come too
no
far
fear. Yeah.
And he's white, so you're like
yeah,
I mean nobody cares because he's white, but like
yeah,
if that was a brown person who's wearing no pants,
he would have gotten stopped immediately before even getting into the Waffle
well
House.
Also he would like brown genitalia would be banned.
Yeah,
like they would just cut them all off of us.
Okay, ow.
Just saying. We have no rights in this country.
But also, thanks, guys, for... We got really good responses about our episode last week, and it was really nice to hear you guys respond so well to the podcast about Syria, and it was nice. And I'm personally really proud of that episode, so I'm glad it resonated with so many of you. And I hope our podcast can continue to live up to that standard that we've set for ourselves. But we'll see. I hope so. I think I can. Maybe. I don't know.
Maybe we peaked.
Yeah, I don't know. That's sad.
Yeah, we got a lot of nice peaked feedback. Peaked at 39. People liked it, but like, who knows, man? Who knows where we'll go now?
Yeah.
Now this entire episode is just going to be about me shitting my pants. So, guys, sorry.
It took a turn. It's
downhill
a turn.
From here. Yeah. Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
Yeah. Well, because I've been kind of in a sad rut lately. I mean, not really. I mean, the current political climate and everything like that has gotten me down. So my segment today is going to be kind of historical, because that's, I feel like it gets me, I'm more motivated to research it when I'm like, this isn't in our current world, but it happened back then. For some reason, it calms me down. History.
Real quick, something I've noticed is you've been wearing a lot of jumpsuits lately.
Uh-huh.
Is that part of it?
Well,
are you just ready for war at any point?
Exactly. Yeah, I'm just ready to have one piece of clothing on only.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm wearing an army green jumpsuit right now.
It's very utilitarian.
Thank you so much. I love that word.
that's so funny. Okay.
Do you? But yeah, it's I'm just playing around with some different silhouettes. You know. Yeah, I'm into it. I'm into the jumpsuit look for sure. It's like androgynous, utilitarian.
Silhouettes.
Yeah. What are you going to talk about today?
Sorry, that was a real life confirmed yawn. I am going to talk about the Iran nuclear deal. Break it down. What it is, what it does, who it does, what it does, what it is.
Yeah.
Was that clear?
Well, do you want to get into it? We should just get into it, right?
You want me to do it?
Yeah.
Or you want to go?
You should go.
Wow.
I don't know.
Sure, I'll do it.
Should we Rochambeau?
I don't really. Sure.
Okay. Rock, paper, scissors. So who wins? If I win, I go, or if I win, I don't go.
I don't know.
So whoever wins goes first.
Okay. I don't know what. Okay.
Rock, paper, scissors. Just one game. Just okay. One. One, two, three. Damn it.
Okay, you won. Well, you didn't want to... You know, I'll just go. No, whatever. No, it's fine. It's fine. You clearly don't want to go first.
I just don't want to be...
It's okay. Right I'll go now. First. Why did we even do that? What is going on in this podcast? Sorry, guys. Last week was the best you're going to get. It's all downhill from here.
Stick around, please.
Okay. So, okay. So, okay. Okay, so. That's the kind of magic you can find at Ethnically Ambiguous.
Yep, that's
I'm going to talk about the nuclear deal, which is also called the Iranian nuclear deal, which is also called, it's got a really crazy name too, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, the JCPOA. I don't know, probably no one actually reads the acronym like that, but I just did, so what are you gonna do?
I'm just thinking about Jicama now.
That's okay. I'm gonna start calling it the Jicama deal. Yeah. So the Jicama deal. it happened 2015. So the Iran nuclear deal framework, which was like basically the preliminary framework agreement that was reached in 2015. Sorry, that was one of my signature burps. It was reached in 2015 between Iran and the World Group Powers, aka the P5+1, which is the permanent members of the United Nations Security Council, the U.S., the United Kingdom, Russia, France, China, and Germany, and the European Union. So negotiations of this framework for the nuclear program of Iran took place between all the foreign ministers of the countries that I listed a second ago at a series of meetings that took place between 26th of March to the 2nd of April 2015 in Lausanne, Switzerland. And here's a little tidbit of information about Lausanne, which I'm probably pronouncing wrong. I rented a car there once. Anyway, so
it's true. You've been around.
Yeah, I've been to Switzerland. So on April 2nd, the talks came to a conclusion and a press conference was held by Federica Mogherini, who is the high representative of the Union for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, and Mohammad Javad Zarif, who is the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Iran. And they announced that the eight parties, all the countries I mentioned above, had reached an agreement on a framework deal. And they announced, today we have... We have taken a decisive step. We have reached solutions on key parameters of a joint comprehensive plan of action, which they said would be complete by June 30th, announcing the framework. Foreign Minister Zarif said, no agreement has been reached, so we do not have any obligation yet. Nobody has obligations now other than the obligations that we have already undertook under the joint plan of action that we adopted in Geneva in November 2013. So the deal, the plan of action, was finished or like agreed upon, I don't know, signed, if you will, on July 14, 2015. And the first initial framework lifted crippling economic sanctions on Iran in return for limitations on the country's controversial nuclear energy program, which a lot of people around the world feared that Iran would use to make a nuclear weapon. So I'm going to break down really quickly what we get out of the deal. So Iran has two uranium enrichment facilities in Iran, in Natanz and Fordo, which low-enriched uranium can be used to produce fuel for nuclear power plants. So Iran had almost like 20,000 centrifuges where they were doing this, where they were enriching uranium, if you will. I don't really understand science, so I'm doing the best I can to explain how nuclear weapons work, if you will. So just be patient with me. So under the JCPOA, which was the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, like I said earlier, which was AKA just the nuclear Iran deal, Iran would be limited to installing no more than about a little over 5,000 of their like oldest and least efficient centrifuges for about 10 years. Does that make sense? Who knows? So also Iran's uranium stockpile is to be reduced by 98% for 15 years. So as of January 2016, Iran has drastically reduced the number of centrifuges installed at those two cities I named earlier. And they shipped a ton of low-enriched uranium to Russia, which...
That sounds like a great idea.
Yes, there's something about that that rubs me the wrong way.
Anything involving Russia is shady business.
Right, and so as well, they said research and development will be limited for 8 years. And in one city, there will be like absolutely no uranium enrichment, which I believe is Fordo. For 15 years, there will be no research. And the underground facility will be converted into a like technology center and be used to like produce stuff for medicine, agriculture, industry, and science. So Iran has also been building a heavy water nuclear facility near the town of Arak. So fuel from the heavy water reactor, it contains plutonium, which is suitable for a nuclear bomb. World powers, they really wanted this dismantled, which was part of the original nuclear deal, which was agreed upon in November 2013. Yeah, so that stopped. So most of the 20 tons of heavy water the Arak facility had was expected to produce is shipped to the U.S. via a third country, mm-hmm. via a third country, okay, like go somewhere, I don't know where, and then to the U.S. And so the agreement says that Iran will not be permitted to build additional heavy water reactors or accumulate any excess heavy water for 15 years. And another part of the deal says that there is no covert activity allowed. And what that means is as part of the agreement, Iran is not allowed to build a nuclear program in secret. And Iran has committed to not do this. And they have also committed to extraordinary and robust monitoring, verification, and inspection. So inspectors from the IAEA, which is the Global Nuclear Watchdog, they will continuously watch Iran's nuclear sites and verify that there's basically nothing going on secretly or there's no secret locations mm-hmm. that bombs are being built. They also implemented the additional protocol to their IAEA safeguards agreement, which basically allows inspectors from the IAEA to access any site in the country where they find any suspicious activity going on.
Okay.
And so that's 15 years.
Why is it 15 years?
I don't know. That's just what they agreed to. Yeah. I think in 15 years, then they double.
Either renew it or...
They renew it or decide what to do next. Yeah, so if the IAEA discovers anything...
Right. They're in trouble.
Yeah, they're in trouble. So before July 2015, Iran had a huge stockpile of enriched uranium. Like I said, over 20,000 centrifuges, enough to create basically 8 to 10 bombs, according to the White House. So experts from the U.S. estimated that if Iran had decided to make a bomb, it would take them about 2 to 3 months.
Oh, shit.
So that's apparently called the breakout time, like the time it takes you to like...
To break out a bomb.
Yeah. So the agreement, it removes like the key elements Iran would need to create that bomb.
Okay.
So it increases the breakout time to about a year or more, which doesn't seem like a lot of time, but who am I? Anyway, so Iran agreed not to engage in any suspicious activity that includes research and development, which, you know, could lead to creating a bomb. They were like, we won't do it. And the IAEA's Board of Governors, they basically, in December 2015, decided to end a long, like a 10-year-long investigation into the possible military dimensions of Iran's nuclear program. The agency's director general, Yukiya Amano, he said in a report that until 2003, Iran had conducted a coordinated effort on a range of activities relevant to the development of nuclear explosive device. And Iran continued with some activities until 2009, but after that, there were no credible indications of weapons development. So they're in the clear for now. Another thing, the big thing that came with this is the sanctions were lifted. So sanctions were imposed by the UN, the US, and the European Union in an attempt to force Iran to halt uranium enrichment. And that crippled its economy. It cost the country more than $160 billion in oil revenue from about 2012 to 2016. And according to the deal, Iran would gain access to about $100 billion in assets frozen overseas. And so they were able to resume selling oil on international markets. So they could basically make all that money back.
Okay.
But if Iran does anything to violate any aspect of the deal, the UN will automatically snap those sanctions back for 10 years and could get a possible 5-year extension with it. And if the Joint Commission couldn't resolve the problem, it would be referred to the UN Security Council. And that's, you know, they're not going to fuck around.
Yeah.
Also, Iran agreed to a continuation of the UN arms embargo on the country. So basically, they wouldn't be sold weapons. Whatever. It's not like other countries that get weapons all day in the Middle East.
So do you think Iran is going to play by the rules?
I mean, they have so far.
Mm-hmm. It's not like Syria and their like false cooperation kind of thing.
Well, it's hard to say because Iran's a little... They'll play by the rules, but sometimes there's been some issues. Like early last year, Iran was put on notice by Michael Flynn, who we all know is a crazy person, because they were doing ballistic missile testing,
right,
which they say falls in the agreement. And then Trump and people said it didn't fall in the agreement, like it wasn't okay. So it's a little iffy like that. Mm-hmm. Like they will probably get away by just barely skirting the line of what's okay. But I think for the most part, they will stay in line because those sanctions are so important that they're lifted.
Right.
Like they gain so much more. And I'm actually going to get into a little bit more about why or like what else they get basically and all that. So, I'll kind of break down what happens if the agreement is ripped up by Trump. All right. So President Trump, like you've heard, because Obama made that deal, he fucking hates it and says it's shady and it doesn't work. So
the only reason he hates it is because Obama had anything to do with it.
Yeah, he says it's insane and it should just basically be thrown out because it sucks. I will get into a little more about that after this break. And we are back.
Yeah.
All right. So before the break, I was talking a little about the nuclear deal. So I'm going to break down a little what will happen if the nuclear deal is terminated by Trump.
Mm-hmm.
So real quick, President Emmanuel Macron, French president, said he expected Trump to pull out of the deal in the next month for domestic reasons. But German Chancellor Angela Merkel is lobbying for Trump to stick with it and they're meeting soon. Europe is trying to save the deal because... It says it's a good deal. It works in everyone's favor. It helps lift economic sanctions and it makes Iran agree to rein in its nuclear program. Trump says it's the worst deal ever. And yeah. So John Mathis, who is the U.S. Secretary of Defense, wants him to stay in it. But who really knows what will happen because Trump is a giant mm-hmm. baby person. So here is some of the things that will happen if the agreement goes to shit. So Iran has the fourth largest oil reserves in the world, and they have nearly one-fifth of the planet's natural gas. So they ease out about 3.8 million barrels a day.
Y'all are gassy.
How dare you?
Sorry.
Yeah, we are. So if new sanctions are put on that, then that's going to put a dent in the global oil supply. And guess what? Our oil prices are going to spike like crazy. So we will be paying a shit ton of money for gas in America. So, great.
Womp womp.
So that's one thing. A big thing in Iran because of the sanctions is they weren't allowed to get a lot of parts, like new. They weren't basically allowed to buy new parts for things like airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of their planes are old and there's just a bad reputation when it comes to flying within the country of Iran. It's always a situation. So Boeing signed an $8 million deal to sell 80 jets to Iran after the sanctions were lifted. And the first few jets are supposed to be delivered this year. So if that gets shut down, Boeing will have to fire tens of thousands of people in the U.S. who work on these planes. Yeah, because about 100,000 Boeing employees are involved in making these planes up for the deal. So yeah, tight. Thanks, Trump. Really killing those jobs. Also, General Electric has received millions of dollars for oil and gas business from Iran, so that would be gone. Total has signed a $2 billion agreement to help develop Iran's giant South Pars gas field, along with the China state oil company CNPC, which, again, would go to shit if that was gone. Germany's Volkswagen was planning on selling cars in Iran for the first time in 17 years, so that would also fall apart. So European airlines such as British Airlines and Lufthansa have resumed flying in to Iran, but of course, with sanctions, that would basically go away. Also, I think one of the biggest things for Iran is their economy would get fucked really hard. Mm-hmm. Like I said, they would lose their ability to sell oil globally. And
so that's like a big reason why they should play nice kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Because it works in their favor.
Yeah.
These sanctions are so fucked. Like, it would not work out for them. So Suzanne Maloney, she's a fellow at the Brookings Institution. She wrote, as the full suit of American sanctions, including penalties on importing Iranian crude oil, snap back into place, Iran's precarious economic situation will certainly deteriorate. And by that, she means the Iranian rial, which is like their dollar or what they call their money. In the last few months, it's like plunged against the U.S. dollar. So the currency has lost roughly a third of its value over the past year. And the decline, they believe, is steeper. On black market exchanges, and the fall has made imports more expensive, and some Iranians are apparently cashing out their savings to buy dollars and euros.
Wow.
So, yeah, like that, the unhappiness over the economy and the government's management of the situation, that's like kind of what fueled a lot of those protests, which we talked about earlier this year, or it was like late 2017 when that was happening. So, yeah, a lot is being held up by this Iran nuclear deal, and I think it's very important that we stay in it.
So Trump just needs to suck it up and forget that Obama had anything to do with it, so he can just not fuck up the whole thing.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, I guess we'll see what happens. Hopefully Trump doesn't fuck everything up like he usually does.
Yeah.
And let's hope for the best.
Yeah.
So that's my breakdown. I'm sorry if it was shitty. I was doing the best. It's very hard to understand science. I'm not a science person.
Well, we did get a review recently that said we're smart. Me and you are smarter than we think we are. So I think that's true. We smart.
Hmm.
Yeah. So my stuff is a little bit more, I guess it's not as topical historical, or I mean, like, it's not relevant right now to what's going on, but it's actually brought to my attention from a listener, Audrey Luby. She emailed us a couple weeks ago. And she said she wanted to reach out because she thought she's found a story about a Syrian woman that she thought was really interesting. She thought it was good for the podcast. And I agree. I'm going to be talking today about Nazik El-Abid. And she is super cool. She is a revolutionary hero that she fought against Ottoman and French colonization in Syria. And she was a pioneer for both national independence and women's rights. Her name is one of many that are used in the current Syrian revolution against Assad, and she's been a symbol of national unity and a struggle for freedom, and she is known as the Syrian Joan of Arc, which I will get into why that is in a second. But basically, she was born in the late 1880s. Like, one site said 1890 or 98, another one said 88. So her date of birth is
88, or what was the other one?
1898 or 88. It's like one, it's just some one of those years. It's
like 3 years apart.
Yeah. So she was born in 1898, and she was the daughter of an aristocrat and an insider of the court of the Ottoman Sultan. And one of these articles that I'm reading, her third cousin is like remembering what she was like, and he said that she was very liberal with strong character and very critical of the Ottoman. Governing the Syrians. And she was exiled a number of times. The first time she was exiled was when she was a young student in Mosul in Turkey, and she saw Turkish teachers discriminate against Arab students, and then she organized a mass protest to get teachers fired, and then this resulted in her getting kicked out of the school in Mosul and of the entire country, and she was sent to Damascus. That was exile number one.
Oh, wow.
And then, And then as soon as she got to Damascus, she was still very politicized and wanted to make change. And so she started a women's rights club, which was the very first of its kind in Syria when she got to Syria. And the club advocated for the right to vote for women, as well as Syrian independence from the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire did not like this, and so she was kicked out with her entire family out of Syria the second time she was exiled. And even though her family had connections to the Ottoman Empire, they were still very proud of their Arab roots. And so even though her political stance was controversial, her family was not unsupportive of that. And she held anti-colonial views, even though her family, again, was connected to the empire. And her father, for example, was a governor of Mosul, and her uncle was a private advisor to the Sultan. So she was very well-connected, very wealthy, and she kind of turned that all down for a more activism role in society. Her third cousin goes on, he says, she was a humble person, she loved sports, she was the only woman at the time who wore trousers and boots and carried a whip. So I think it's kind of badass that she's remembered that way. Yeah. So following her student years, after all these exiles of twice, basically, so far, she was a vocal critic of the Ottoman and French policies in her country, because after the Ottoman Empire fell in 1920, the French colonized Syria. And so in 1919, she led a women's delegation that discussed the French mandate in Syria with the American King Crane Commission. And it was tasked with determining the attitudes of Syrians and Palestinians towards the settlement of their territories. So when French assumed the mandate of Syria in 1920, she was the only Syrian woman to take up arms and join Youssef el-Ezma, who was Syrian's then defense minister, in the military battle of Massalon. But before I get into the battle, so when the Ottoman Empire fell, it was basically the first time Syria was free, in quotes, after 400 years of being others' subjects. I say quotes because that's when French started colonizing Syria. And so she fought very hard for the women's right to vote in Syria, and she gave speeches and eventually met the U.S. ambassador without a veil, which was very controversial at the time, because she wanted to pressure the U.S. for help. And
I'm sorry to interrupt. Was it, when you say she met without a veil, like, was it?
At the time, the country was like a conservative country.
Like a conservative Islamic country?
Yeah. Mm. Had her suffrage efforts been passed, Syria might have gotten the women the right to vote before the United States. But unfortunately, the French did not. Were not into that idea, and they destroyed that government debate, basically. So the French did not want the Syrians to govern themselves, and the Syrian king at the time surrendered to avoid mass bloodshed, essentially. But his minister of defense did not want to go out without a fight. And so France, he fought with his 1,500 untrained troops, and France had 9,000 well-trained troops, and they fought in a big battle, and Nazik was the only woman in this battle. And so there's an image of her in military attire without her veil, with a rifle slung over her shoulder. And this image was in every newspaper, and the articles called her the Sword of Damascus, or the Syrian Joan of Arc. And so these are her two nicknames that she, because of this, these pictures of her, the only woman in military attire in this battle, and was also, she was the only survivor of this battle, and people were saying that's because she had experience as a medic. Because of these photos, she was given these nicknames, and people were very supportive of her, people that were not in the government, or the French government. And so after the battle ended, and the French obviously won, she was exiled for the third time. And she, 2 years later, she came back, though, after on the condition that she gave up politics. So after her third exile, she was gone for 2 years, and she came back. And technically, she gave up politics, but she enabled other people to do her kind of work. She opened a women's rights organization called Nur al-Faya, which is, it's called, it translates to Light of Damascus. And she co-administrated a school for orphans and started the Red Crescent, which is Syria's version of the Red Cross.
Nice.
And at some point along these endeavors, she pissed off a politician again, and she was exiled to Jordan. So that's her fourth exile.
So she just gets kicked around because she's trying to do work.
Exactly. She's trying to do the right thing. She just angers people in power. And she was a very strong advocate for women. And her liberal views about women were less welcomed by her family, unfortunately, because she removed her veil several times in public and in front of television cameras. And unlike her sisters, she was unmarried until she was in her 40s, and then she had lived alone on a farm, basically, in a rural area of Damascus. So even though her family were very open-minded and modern compared to the mentality at the time, they did not always like her behavior because she did not listen to them, and she did whatever she wanted to do. So she was just a free thinker, basically.
Inappropriate.
Exactly. And as an activist for women's suffrage and resistance to the Ottoman Empire, when she was younger, she often wrote under a male pseudonym for Damascus newspapers during the 1919 Syrian Women's Movement, which I think is really cool. She was just, she wanted to get her voice out there, and so she knew the way to do that was to adopt a male name. Yeah, so then when she established the Syrian Red Crescent, it led to the opening of a women's branch of the international organization in Syria in 1922. So, which I think is really cool. She was the first woman to ever, it was the first time anything like that was ever in Syria, and it was all because of her. And then when she came back to Syria after those 2 years in exile, it was because the French government granted her amnesty. She was exiled because the Light of Damascus, the paper that she created, it was viewed as competition for resources with French humanitarian agencies and programs, and the French authorities threatened to arrest her, and that's when she fled for Syria and lived in Lebanon for a very long time. And then in 1933, she established the Working Women Society, and that worked on labor issues on behalf of women in Syria and advocated for economic liberation as a means to political liberation for women. And then, let's see.
Quick question. Yeah. Where didn't she live in the Middle East?
She was just all over the place because she kept getting exiled. But in Lebanon, when she was in Lebanon, that's where she met her future husband. And even though she didn't marry him until her 40s, it was because she was getting shit done.
Wow.
Priorities, you know?
Did she ever have any kids?
No. By the time she died, she was back home in Syria, and it was a free nation, and women were joining the workforce and going out in public alone, and unveiling with abandon, basically. And a decade later, women began being elected to the parliament. And regardless what comes after that for Syria, as we all know, was not great because of the Assad regime. The strides for equality for women were in large part because of Nazik al-Abid. And it's kind of crazy because she was born into luxury and fought very hard for women that had it that were less fortunate than she was. So, yeah, I think she's... I mean, I didn't know about her at all until Audrey sent this email about her. And
thank you, Audrey.
I know. It's so just, she's such a badass. Like, the more I read about her, the more I like her. She's, her struggle was all about desire for a more liberal secular Syria. And she, I mean, her efforts were not in vain, because Syria eventually did become more liberal and secular. Yeah, so that's who I wanted to talk about, and I encourage you guys to look her up and read about her. It's just so cool, just like imagining this woman with like just like her, like with the rifle over her shoulder, like just.
I like that she had a whip.
Yeah, I know.
There's something like so cool badass of just being like, I will fucking whip you.
Yeah. Yeah, and we will come back after this break. We're back. Yeah, I was just finishing up talking about how much I love Nazik. I really hope I'm pronouncing your name right, but I think it is Nazik. And I didn't know we had a Joan of Arc, you guys. We have an Arab Joan of Arc this whole time.
Is that who Joan of Arc is based off of, or is Joan of Arc based off of a real Joan of Arc?
I think Joan of Arc is real. Yeah.
I don't know. I truly don't know anything about American history.
But
I don't think I've ever been more checked out than my upbringing and education.
No.
I'm not even joking. I'm a terrible student.
There is a really cool, in 2011, the Syrian basically like mail service, there's a stamp of Nazik on a Syrian postage basically, and she looks really cool.
Oh, that's tight. Is it a forever stamp?
No, I don't know. They don't have forever stamps in Syria.
How do you know?
There's no forever on the stamp I'm looking at right now. It's just her.
Let me see it.
It's right there. Forever stamp. No, it's not a forever stamp.
She looks dope.
Yeah, she's dope. She's really cool. And just someone that worked her whole life to improve the lives of women. And she died in 1959.
And that was Syria fully secular by then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool. It was in power. Hafez al-Assad.
She got to live to see a secular Syria, at least.
Yeah, she lived to see a secular Syria and women joining the workforce, and I'm glad she saw her efforts paid off. And I'm also glad she's not alive right now, because she would get really sad.
Yeah. But maybe if she was, Bashar al-Assad wouldn't be in power, because she would have, like, done like one of those whip moves where she would grab his neck and it would just snap his neck,
like Mortal Kombat. Like, yeah. What's her name? Fucking, I forget. But whatever. Yeah.
So that's Wabak.
Yeah. Women like this are just they inspire me, and I hope it was educational for you. Sorry that I jumped all over the place, but they're just different websites that say different things, but
different websites.
But she's a rebel, and I'm all about being a rebel and being someone that stands up for you, believe in. And go Nazik. Nazik forever. We are I was thinking of either titling this episode We Are Nuclear. Nuclear.
Let's not bring up nuclear bombs. We're a bomb. We are the bomb.
I mean,
it's just like literally Homeland Security helicopters to our
I remember when one of my stand-up jokes or whatever was like, I can't say that I've bombed as an Arab. And I think that's true. You can't say bombed in any way. You can't say that's the bomb. You can't say, you know what I mean? Like, that word is like not cool for anyone to say. That's a brown person.
We are the bomb.
We can't say that.
We should call this episode We Are the Bomb.
We are the bomb.
That's pretty funny, though. It's very like 90s.
Yeah.
Early aughts, if you will.
Yeah. Early aughts?
2000s.
What's aughts?
I don't know. I've heard people say it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Word.
Early aughts.
For our personal segment, we should bring back the personal segment more often, because I think it's a really good thing to just get personal, you know?
We never have the time, Mom.
But we should make the time. We wanted to talk about it was like.
Real quick, just a quick update. Miles of Gray is looking through the window. He's looking for his fidget spinner.
No, he's not.
He's trying to see if it's broken.
No, he's not.
Yes, he is.
If you guys didn't witness the fidget spinner Twitter gate. Are you for this cord?
Yeah. What a crazy person. Mazagray just busted into our recording looking for his broken fidget spinner.
Get the fuck out of here.
Get the fuck out of here.
Your mustard ass cap. Get.
Damn. That's a Miles Gray special for you.
Anyway. If you guys, last episode I broke a fidget spinner and we found out on Twitter that it was Miles and we had a whole thing about it on Twitter, so you just go catch up if you guys want
to
know.
Every fidget spinner in this office belongs to Miles Gray.
I did not know that. And yep. The one I broke just happened to be one that his girlfriend bought for him in Washington, D.C.
At the White House.
And it's like it's an American flag fidget spinner and... if that's not irony, I don't know what is. But for our personal segment, before we were interrupted so rudely by Miles fucking Gray.
You really just throw that door open.
I wanted to talk a little bit about what it was like for us to visit our homelands as when we were growing up. You know, like, what was it like for me to visit Syria and for you, Anna, to visit Iran?
You know what I always remember? Visiting Iran was my first experience with... I've, like, from as young as I am, I want to say... I had my first birthday in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And my first memory
mm-hmm.
is standing, like, at the top of... Like, my mom or dad was holding me. Someone was holding me. And I was standing at the top of... I don't know what those things are called. Like the stairs, they like roll up to planes because they land on the tarmac.
Right. Yeah.
That's like my first memory is like exiting the plane and it's like really dark and cold and I'm like looking out into the distance and we had just landed in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that weird? That's a weird memory, right? And yeah, and we're at the top of that stairs thingy. And that was my first experience, I think, I guess I was one, so... I had a very young experience of my first. It's not like actually walking through the like terminal thingies. I don't know, like the pathways.
I have a lot of memories in airports too, though. Like I just remember because my mom's family or my dad's family sometimes too, they would greet us at the airport. And so I just remember after this long ass journey, just hugging my family and them being so excited to see us because we were finally there. And, I just remember the drive from the airport to my grandparents' place. Or there's always like this like yellow hue in my memories, like either the lights or something. But like
that's a thing in the Middle East.
Yeah,
there's like a yellow vibe going on.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's like an aura thing. I don't know about auras, but I know there's a yellow aura in the Middle East.
I don't know much about auras. So I can tell you right now.
But yeah, I remember. Especially as younger, when I was younger, like before I was a teenager, because we visited Syria like basically every summer, every other summer, until like 6 years ago, maybe 7 years ago. But when we were younger, my sisters and I were like the American cousins, and we would always bring like, I remember they didn't have peanut butter or popcorn, like microwavable popcorns. We would like bring like peanut butter and popcorn for our favorite cousins of ours, and they were like amazed.
Popcorn there. That's actually
They do now, but I remember in the 90s we introduced peanut butter to them, and it was like they were obsessed.
I remember my cousins being like, "Yeah, you brought all these Smarties with you once," and I was like, "Damn, I was fucking fiending Smarties at that young age. Like, I'm still fucking with Smarties so hard.
Yeah.
Like, you know how much I talk about Smarties.
Oh, for sure. A lot. Yeah. Every day.
Like, I recently, 3 or 4 years ago when I went, like, one of my cousins for the first time, like, reminded me of my, like, Smarties problem.
Well, like, did you guys, I remember for us, a big part about being, like, a kid in Syria, we would, like, spend our days, especially because the adults would take, like, afternoon naps after lunch.
Yeah.
So during that, like, siesta period, the kids would, like, go to a nearby shop and just get so many snacks and candies and ice cream and chips. And that was, like, a big, like, or soda. And these glass bottles that we would return to the dekane, like, the shop later. It was, like,
yeah.
I have so many memories of that. And
I don't know if we did that, but we... In Middle Eastern culture, children are treated almost like adults in the sense that or I guess an Iranian, I don't know if it's the same as you, where you don't go to bed early. Like, no, you stay up all night, basically, yeah. And, like, hang out with everyone.
Yeah.
Like, you can be, like, five and just being, like, yeah. drinking tea and in a conversation. Yeah. And you're like, he can't really, yeah. she or he can't.
I remember when we finally were able to play cards with everyone, when we finally got to the age where we can play cards with my mom's, with my uncles and everything, that was like, oh, we've made it. Like, we're not kids anymore. We can play cards with you guys now. And if we weren't playing cards, we were, like, on the music video channel that was just, like, there's a channel in Arabic television where it's just music videos. And Arabic music videos are so, I mean, I'm sorry, but they're lame. They're so sad and cheesy. They're cheeseball central. But there's, like, a couple of channels that are dedicated to music videos, and my cousins and I would just watch them constantly.
I don't remember that as much. I know it's just, like, a lot of, like Turkish programming mm-hmm. when I was growing up, because yeah. that's, like, where all the, like, soap operas and stuff are made.
Yeah.
And then they're broadcast in Iran. That's...
They're in Syria, too. They're all about Turkish soap operas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just, like... And I never really fully understood it, because I was just kind of like, this is dramatic. And now... Mm-hmm. More so recently, when I was last there, they were watching, like, almost like a Turkish The Bachelor.
Mm-hmm.
Or, like, almost like a, maybe a Big Brother of a That's sort.
Interesting, yeah.
It was, like, a bunch of guys and girls in a house together.
Yeah.
And they're, like, dating. Sorry. Our yeah. feet touched, by the way.
That was intimate.
That's...
And there's also, like, in recent history, I know the Arabic, or, like, the Middle Eastern version of The Voice has gotten super popular.
Right.
Super popular. But I really miss this. It's just sad to me that the feelings I had in Syria, because especially in my mom's hometown, she's from Hama, and it's this country town, like a couple of hours out of Damascus, and there are these giant, like, Roman water wheels, essentially, and they make, they're like these giant wheels that are, they make this, like, really otherworldly creaking sound when they move and they transport this water. It's just like this.
You talked about this before, right?
Yeah, it's just, there's a feeling you get when you're in Syria that you can feel the history and the art and the beauty in it. And I feel like I can never experience that again. And it's a very, I remember as a kid feeling this feeling. Well, like, I couldn't explain it. And I think as a kid, especially as a kid that's the American in Syria, or you the American in Iran, and then coming back here and you're the alien here too, I never really felt like I belonged anywhere, because I would either, like, I don't know, when I would talk in Arabic, I would get made fun of for my accent, or, like, when I would talk here, I also had an accent. So it was like, when I was in Syria, though, regardless of anything else, there was a feeling that I felt there that it's like something made sense. Did you feel that for Iran at all? Like,
yes.
Like, even if you were the weirdo there and the weirdo here, there's a feeling there.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, no one would know I'm an American until I open my mouth fully.
Right.
Because, yeah, I speak Farsi in an accent.
Like, yeah, same.
And people, like, laugh. They'll be like, it's so cute. She, like, speaks with
Farsi that makes it in an so American much worse. Accent.
And you're like, yeah, totally. But
did your mom and dad ever tell you not to speak in a taxi?
No.
Like, my parents, I remember when we would get into taxis, would tell me and my sisters to not speak so they wouldn't charge us more money, because they found out we were American.
I think my dad gives it off quite obviously, because my dad has just, like, his whole style of clothing is, like, retired yuppie. And that doesn't translate to Iranian style as much, because, like, men in Iran mostly wear, like, suit jackets. Or right. they dress very, like, business casual.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad wears, like, hoodies and jeans and, like...
Your just, dad is a badass.
Like, loves his Echoes, his, like, comfortable shoes, and does his own thing. Like, my dad wears a hoodie, like, more often than nothing. Like, he just is always in a hoodie.
That's some California culture right there.
And he's always got, like, a pink polo on.
Oh, my gosh.
Like, he's very, like, business casual with a hoodie. It's very strange. My dad's style is weird. He also loves to wear, like, all denim outfits, where he'll wear, like, jeans and, like,
damn,
a denim button-down.
Tuxedo.
Yeah, he's, like, really into that. So his look is definitely like, this guy's not from here.
Yeah.
And then me, I think I just look eccentric.
Yeah.
Because I have glasses and weird hair, but I don't know.
I think it is something, like, my mom, when I see pictures of her in the 80s and stuff, she was someone that commanded attention. Like, her fashion was, like, so on point, very Western, very, like, inspired by European stuff. I think that just makes sense because our parents ended up coming here. So they both had, both my parents and your parents probably had an idea of themselves that was bigger than their country, you know?
Right.
Which is kind of cool. And I don't think the apple falls far from the tree because my sister, me and my sisters too, we would kind of stick out even if we weren't trying.
Right. Yeah. Same. And I love wearing denim on denim as well. It's not even a joke. Yeah. I mean, I think I also don't speak in taxis because I just don't want to be spoken to.
Copy. Yeah.
I draw in as little interaction as possible unless it's with my family.
Mm-hmm.
I always get, like, it's weird, like, people always, like, when I'm in Iran and, like, other family members, like, extended people or, like, family friends who come to visit who maybe haven't seen me in a while, obviously, because I'm not there always, all the time, they'll be like, oh, she's so well-behaved, like, she's so, like...
Because you're quiet?
Yeah, and it's like, no, I'm quiet because I'm not trying to start a conversation with you yeah. about anything. Like, I talk to my family, but I also don't really want to get into, like, shit with you because I'm the American and I don't know what you're gonna say to me. Like, I've had interactions with older Iranian women in Iran who have just been straight rude and hurtful to me because I'm the American and I don't understand, like, a certain, like, I remember I was at my, what was I at? Oh, I think it was my, this shit actually really irritated me. It was at my uncle's funeral. No, it was like one of the reception dinner funeral things. It was just like an event because those funerals last for like a week in Iran. And it was more the 40-day celebration, which is like the soul leaves the body after 40 days.
Yeah.
So you get together at 40 days after the death. And I believe everyone kept being like, take your coat off, take your coat off. Because they separate where the women and men eat.
Yeah.
Men eat downstairs, women eat upstairs.
Mm-hmm.
So I was surrounded by women that kept being like, please be comfortable, be comfortable, be comfortable. Take your coat off, be comfortable. And I was like, no, I just don't want to do it. Like, please just leave me. Let me just be. I don't want to stand out. Because they want you to be comfortable because you're, like, the cousin who's visiting. And they want everything to, like,
they're very, be they're comfortable very, like, for you. And... what's the word? Like, overly polite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's a part of it that... well, anyway. And I was like, fine. I'll take my coat off. And one of the women who is... this woman is related to me through marriage.
Mm-hmm.
She kind of got, like, a bitch face. She, from across the room, while everyone's, like, saying their goodbyes and leaving, is, like, I guess I put my jacket on my chair and then it fell to the ground or something. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I wasn't paying attention because I was, like, saying goodbye to people. I was, like, interacting with people. And she yells from across the room, like, Anna. And this is all in Farsi. And everyone can hear this because it's, like, a ballroom. So it's, right. like, echoey. And she's, like, pick up your coat off the ground. Don't you understand the culture here? You can't just walk around like that. And I turn and look at her like, bitch, you are not talking to me. And I just look at her. I give her the blankest expression because I'm just like, who are you? And then I just turn away back to the person. But I'm like hurt because I'm just like, fuck you. Like, you guys are harassing me. Like, I'm in a foreign country.
Yeah.
Yes, this is my family. But you don't know me that well.
Yeah.
You're not that. You're literally in my family through marriage.
Yeah.
So I don't know you.
Yeah.
And you're some older lady who's just being a bitch to be a bitch. And so I, like, look at her. I'm like, whatever. And I turn back. I don't even pick up my coat because I'm like, oh, you're ain't my mama. And, so, and I'm like, whatever. And then I think she, like, says something else to me, but I don't turn around.
Yeah.
I don't really even remember because I was just kind of like, ugh.
That's so annoying.
But it was such bad vibes. Like, it was just, like, it was truly, like, one of the grossest things that's... I was so shaken by her because I was like, oh. Ugh, like, you have no respect for people.
Right,
like,
yeah.
I would never put it... Like, it's one thing to walk over and be like, hey, your coat's on the ground, pick it up. Versus yelling across a room at me.
And saying, like, making it seem like you're not a part of the culture.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, blatantly pointing out that I don't belong here.
Yeah.
And clearly I was raised somewhere else and don't understand.
Like, fuck you,
and
bitch.
That shit hurt.
Yeah.
And so, like, I was like, fuck off. So I say goodbye to, like, whoever was sitting at my table, take my shit, go downstairs, find my dad, and say, can we just go? I need to get out of this place. Like, it's just too much. My dad's like, what's wrong? And I'm like, I just want to go. Like, let's roll out. And so my cousin comes up to me, and he's like, what's wrong? And I'm like, and this is all the dudes are downstairs, so they're being like, what's wrong? Why are you so upset? And I'm, like, trying to be cool. I'm just being like, let's just go. Let's just go in the car and leave. Like, please, can we just go? And then, but then they're all like, well, why do you want to go so quick? Like, what's wrong? What's wrong? What's wrong? And then all of a sudden, like, my mafia family are around me being like, who said what to you? Who said what to you? Point her out. Point her out. My little five-year-old cousin comes up and goes, I will cut her eye out. You tell me who said what to you. And I'm like, oh, goddamn. Now I got the five-year-old riled up. And I'm like, no, 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 RS, chill, 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 chill. Yeah. Like, no, 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 it's chill, it's chill. It was, I actually created a scene by just trying to be like, not create a scene and get out of there, where everyone was just like, but that's the thing is,
Arabs don't like, I mean, Middle Easterners don't let things go.
Well, though. Yeah, but that's the thing. They're so protective of me because I'm the American cousin and they want me to be comfortable that, like, they were all ready to literally drag this woman out of there. Like, they're like, tell me who it was. And I was like, literally, like, I'm not, let's just go. Let's get out of here. We'll talk about it at the house.
Yeah.
And so they're all being like, like scoping people out, being like, who said what to you? And so, like, my, and that's the thing, wherever I go in Iran, like, I'm surrounded by, like, all my male and cousins and uncles who are just making sure no one bothers me at all times. So they, like, take me out, put me in a car, take me back to the house, and then I tell them who it was, and my cousin's like, oh, she's a bitch. She said some bitchy shit to me, too. I think at one point, she had said something to my cousin who, and I talked about this last time, I think, or a few episodes back, where she, this woman, so she's my aunt who married my uncle who passed away. It's one of her, it's like her, like, brother's wife. So that's how we're related. So it's like a marriage through a marriage. Right. That's how we're related. So this woman had said to my cousin, who was badly burned when my uncle's house was blown up, and her fiance left her, even though she was supposed to be married a week later.
Oh, yeah, I remember this, yeah.
And then she basically was getting married to a new guy, that's who she's married to now. When she heard about this, she said near my cousin, she didn't say it directly to my cousin, but she said it close enough where it was, like, clearly just, like, wanting her to hear, said, well, of course she's able to get a new husband. Like, these Hosnia women, they like, basically go through men, like, very easily, you know? And so my whole family's already been like, this is a bitch. So, like, she already says, basically made comments that my cousin was, a sleazy because her original fiance left her because she was badly burned, as if that was her choice, and now she's remarrying. Yeah. So they were like, oh, this woman, don't fuck with her. Like, they're immediately like, you know what? She's a bitch. Don't worry about her.
Yeah. And I think respect is such a big thing in Middle Eastern culture, especially within families. I think the minute that someone is disrespectful or something, they're kind of just, like, written off, and either that or people just don't talk to them for months.
Also, I think there's a level of cattiness that's weird.
Yeah, it is weird.
Like, they talk a lot of shit.
Yeah. I remember I feel like every Middle Eastern family just goes through so much drama in the insular family, because the families are so big. Like, so big, and so many cousins, so many uncles and aunts. I think someone's always going to get mad at someone for something really petty, and the pettiness is, like, another level
that's
of petty.
That's aggressive in my my dad's side.
Yeah.
My dad's side literally be like, oh, yeah, she's not going to come to dinner because her brother said this about his wife. Exactly. And you're like, what? Yeah, why? But that. I'm here.
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, you know. Yeah.
And my mom, my mom is far more liberal than the majority of my dad's family. And so my dad's family weren't very supportive of my mom, of his marriage to my mom. So much of the drama in my dad's family kind of was around my mother just being herself. And he's just so fucking dramatic. They'll make stories out of anything. And, like, but yeah, I don't, that's another issue completely.
No, the drama is very real.
Yeah.
But it almost is like they don't really have, I hate to say it, but, like, you know, they live in, like, these countries where you have, like, soap operas on TV, and that's, like, all you watch, and then you, like,
just kind of something to do.
Yeah, like, yeah, to
start,
be like,
shit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's, like,
stir the fucking pot.
Yeah, and it's like, well, I'm not hanging out because he looked at me weird one day. You're like, get over it.
But I will say, thinking of good memories, I have a lot of memories in, like on balconies and, like, apartments, and eating a watermelon in a garden, and fruit, and, like, these green grapes in my grandparents' house in Hama, and pomegranates, and like, juicy watermelon, and just, like, sitting in these, like, rubber chairs, just and just talking, and especially being a kid surrounded by all my uncles and aunts, and just, like,
it's the life.
There's like something about that.
Yeah.
And those gatherings are so sacred to me. And there's something so precious about those memories that they can never be recreated, because there's that's a time where like all your family's in one place and now they're all dispersed. But like there's something so sacred about family time in the Middle East, and just sitting and either smoking or like eating pumpkin seeds or watermelon seeds or nuts or whatever.
Yeah, I think some of my best memories with my uncle who passed away 2 years ago is when I would go to Iran for like a month and mm-hmm. the internet would just be so shitty because mm-hmm. the government controls it, so I couldn't really do anything.
Yeah.
And I would just sit for hours on the porch with my uncle mm-hmm. while he like chain smoked cigarettes. I would just sit next to him and drink tea and eat mixed nuts. And we wouldn't even say anything really to each other. We'd just sit there.
There's just a beautiful vibe.
For hours. Yeah. And just do nothing. And
mixed he would nuts, chain smoke. Smoking, fruit. There's nothing else that you need.
Like sweater vests.
Yeah.
That's always what I remember. My uncle always wore sweater vests. And his cigarettes, the ash would get so long and he just wouldn't ash it. And then it would slowly just fall on his sweater vest and he would just never notice. And to me, it was just so funny. Right. This like well-dressed Persian man's just so out of it just from life, because his son died. All this stuff happened in his life. And his world was just, he was so well off. Like he was just sitting on his beautiful home. But like, so much had gone on, and he was just like this guy who just chain smoke cigarettes and stare off into the distance every once in a while, say something to me like, oh, look at that bird.
Chain smoking and cigarettes in general are such a big part of my family as well. Like I have,
that's what I think, like it takes me to Iran when I like
when I smell cigarettes and or trash
and or just straight garbage.
I have one uncle I had two uncles on my mom's side that came here and then were later, they had to leave America like in the 80s, but my one uncle always is still now wears like a bandana around his neck and is like the very Americanized uncle. He lives in NorCal now. He lives on a farm literally, and
with his son, right?
Yeah. And I just remember giving them like English lessons when we were over there, and they would always say comfortable instead of comfortable, and like all these like these memories that just are so vivid in my mind of being in nature or like in the garden with them and being the special cousins, because we were there for a limited amount of time, but also kind of hating that we were, that it almost, I don't know, but this is a long episode now. I'm gonna shut up.
I do want to say one thing I loved about or love about being the cousin is you could be like, God, I just craving a pizza, and they'll like go get you the closest, like you'll just be seeing them, they'll come back like, I got you the closest thing we have to pizza, and you're like, oh no, you didn't have to, you didn't actually, okay, fine, I'll eat the pizza. It's just funny.
Oh my God, the food there, don't even get started, the food's amazing.
My aunt's cooking
is
the best. Gourmet sabzi all day.
I miss you, Syria. On that note, thanks for joining us for episode 40. You can follow us on Instagram, ethnicallyambig, Twitter, ethnicallyamb. And go to ethnicallyambiguouspod.com and look at the footnotes to see what we, the links of today's episode, basically.
Yes, and rate and review us, please. Five stars,
no less.
Thank you.
Thanks. And again, thanks for everyone that left a review since our last episode. It means so much.
We'll read them on the next episode.
Thanks.
Bye, guys.
Bye.